shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The talk of the town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Bedtime turns me off and I don't need maybe.
Happy New Year. Welcome to Nocturnal Journal here on WGN. We're going to start the year off talking about food and blues. There's no better way to really start the year off by doing that. Our first guest in this abbreviated hour tonight will be Catherine Lambrecht, the president of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance and the founder and moderator of the LTH Forum, the culinary chat site.
Exactly.
And I already forgot one. Thanks for coming down tonight.
You're welcome.
LTH is a restaurant. Where does
little
that come?
Little Three Happiness in Chinatown.
That's it. Right.
The big one has closed, but the little one carries on.
And I know we're going to take a quick break here, but as long as we're on that, how did that start? How did that forum start? I mean, the people hung out at the restaurant, right?
Well, yeah. You know, how it really got started was we were all people that were chatting on Chowhound. And at one point, somebody got a little paranoid and asked some people to leave. And then we decided, well, if they're going to ask those people to leave, what about us? Because we were just as active as those people. And so we sort of started our own website, which was a huge surprise to us.
Very popular. Now, how long ago was that?
We're talking it's about 12 years
ago. Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't an easy transition to being a poster who would occasionally get their post pulled because the moderators didn't like it, to being the moderator's and posters.
Now, that was a little bit ahead of this. You're not supposed to use the word foodie anymore. I read that. But that was before this whole thing happened, right? 12 years ago, things weren't really...
It was just beginning to percolate.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, when people call me a foodie, I don't consider myself a foodie, but I don't argue the point because that's their reference.
And which came first, LTH or the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance? Which one was first?
Actually, in my life, it was Culinary Historians,
okay.
LTH Forum, Chowhound, LTH Forum, Greater Midwest Foodways.
And when did Greatest Midwest Foodways start?
That was 2007.
2007. And what does the organization do?
Well, let me just tell you how we began.
Okay.
It was, I had gone to Southern Foodways to their events for
I know
several
those guys.
Years.
Yeah.
And it was very inspiring, and it was quite an interesting event. And we had also Oxford Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink. We had an event here in Chicago for that. And we did very well. And then Oxford Press offered us $500 to do another event. And I talked to Bruce Craig at the time, and I said, you know, rather than he wanted to do this event, American Food and Drink, once more. And I said, why can't we do something regional like the Midwest? And that little glib comment has kept me occupied for the last, you know, 8-9 years.
And it's interesting. I was down at the, we'll do this later this month, I was down at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans. And they were talking about how do you define the South, and they were talking about people down there. They're talking about including Missouri as a Southern thing. How do you define the Midwest?
Well, I kind of take the classic definition where it's Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota. Nebraska, Kansas. But yes, I can understand why they might consider part of Missouri and also part of Illinois Southern.
Sure.
I mean, in the Civil War, Illinois almost went to the South.
Yeah.
But, you know, and especially when you get even down to Kankakee, which is not that far south from here, you start to feel a little bit of a Southern influence.
It's a long drive through the state of Illinois. I just did it again. I mean, down to Carbondale and Cairo and stuff, it's a long way.
I used to be a master gardener. And when I was a master gardener, that's where I got my education on the state of Illinois. Because when I met people from really down south, like in Carbondale, we were considered way up north. We were practically Wisconsin as far as they were concerned. But central Illinois, from their point of view, was like Springfield.
Yeah.
Whereas a Chicagoan, the moment you leave the metropolitan aura, you think you're downstate.
And how many members are in the organization?
About 100.
And how do you join? I mean...
Oh, I'm happy to have anybody come and join. You know, it's on our website.
And what is your website?
Greater E-R, MidwestFoodways.com. And it's greater because it's the homage to the Great Plains and the Great Lakes.
And are the members from all across the Midwest?
All over the place.
I suppose. And is there a fee? Is there a membership fee?
Yes, and we keep it modest. It's around $35 for an individual, and for a couple it's around $60.
Now, the reason you're on the show, and we're going to get to this after the news,
sure,
is you've got some really great events coming up in 2016. Some involve me, but I'm really excited about your Tupperware thing. So I actually might try. It's on a Sunday, so I might try to swing out to that. So
that would be
I want to talk about that after the news too.
Oh, that would be terrific.
So we'll be back after the news here on WGN Nocturnal Journal with Catherine Lambrecht, the president of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance.
I like whitey meat.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. That's Joe Houston, who we lost, Dan Long, in the wake of Lemmy. Nobody knows Joe Houston passed away, but I love some of those old food songs from the 1950s. We're here with Catherine Lambrecht, president of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance. I have a script, but sometimes I don't stick to it. I was at the break. I was thinking, I know you, but I really don't know you. Where did you grow up, and what is your earliest food memory? Tell me about that.
Well, okay, I've lived the last 40 years or so in Highland Park. My very first food memory, the very first time I cooked anything, I was about 3 years old. My parents didn't get out of bed quickly enough on a Sunday morning, and then they could smell something that smelled like cooking, and they found me in the kitchen standing on a chair frying an egg.
And where was this at?
We were living at this Juneway Terrace and Ashland Avenue here in Chicago.
Wow.
At that time. And then when I was about like 13 or 14, I cooked my first Thanksgiving dinner. And
what did that consist of besides turkey?
It was an article from Gourmet magazine, and it featured, you know, up till then my grandparents, this kind of stuffing we had was the kind of, you know, the bread that they, you know, cut up with their fingers, and there was some onions and celery and a lot of poultry seasoning. Poultry seasoning was a big to do. And that was the stuffing we always had. And I wanted something a little more elevated. So I had, you know, the 1 pound of bread crumbs, and I had sausage and ham and chestnuts. And chestnuts was the big deal because I always heard about chestnuts but hadn't made them. And the instructions didn't tell you how to deal with the chestnuts. And I cut my fingers trying to peel chestnuts by hand. And afterwards, I looked at the joy of cooking and discovered if I had cut an X and put them in the oven at 350 degrees for 15 minutes, they would have been very easy to open.
Wow.
And from that point on, I became a cookbook reader. And then when I was, my family, we went on a trip to Europe when I was about 18 years old, 10 weeks through Europe. And I bought a cookbook in London by Elizabeth David, Spices, Salts, and Aromatics in the English Kitchen, and a few other books, and read them like from edge to edge. And there was not just how to prepare a recipe, but there was cultural context
right
to it, and what people did then and what they do now. And I learned so much. Food became, you know, a larger tapestry than just simply something satisfying your urge to feed yourself.
What'd your parents do?
My dad's an optical engineer. And my mother is a housewife.
Okay. Now, see,
an enthusiastic housewife.
Homemaker, housewife. Now, this is kind of what I try to do in these books I write. You know, I mean, like you just said, there's a much larger picture. And when you talk about food and you get people talking about memory, food and memory and oral histories, these last couple books I've done, they're really not, you know, they're not, I tell people I'm not a food critic, but just using food as a device to tell stories is really fascinating. In a way, is that what you guys do as an organization? Why are foodways important? How do you describe foodways?
Well, certainly we are always touching on memory.
Yeah.
And the history. You know, there's, you know, you could go back historically, like, you know, why did this food end up here? Why do people particularly like this particular food? You know, there's a whole bunch of, you know, there's politics involved, there's geography. There's all sorts of things. But in the end, you're really touching the soul.
And how do you gather that information? I know Peter, I mean, he is a great collector of menus. Do you go out and gather oral histories? Do you have books? I mean, what all does the organization draw on?
Well, Peter is not just a collector of menus.
Yeah.
He also does a lot of footwork.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I mean, you've featured articles like with him and the mother-in-law.
Yeah,
you
right.
know, something he identified, and then he just starts marching around going all over the city to other places that have the mother-in-law.
And tell us what the mother-in-law is.
The mother-in-law is the... like a Tom tamale with chili sauce on it is one variant. Another variant is to put it in a hot dog bun, these Tom type tamales, and dress it like a Chicago hot dog, or put it like chilies and onions. I mean, chili sauce and onions, not chilies. But yeah, he's really quite a thorough investigator. But for instance, like when we go to these state fairs, you know, people write their history. And sometimes the first time that recipe has ever been recorded within that family was what they brought that day to the fair. And that means it's a recipe that could have gone lost.
Yeah.
Because once you lose that context, I mean, my grandmother died when I was almost 16. And she had certain signature dishes that we adored. She was one of those people that had the food prepared when you arrived so she could enjoy your company more. So you didn't get to see how some of these things were prepared. After she died, it took me 2 years to figure out, to reverse engineer and make the dishes in the way that everybody else in our family recognizes.
That was one of the joys of doing it, especially, well, both books, but the Supper Club book, I remember, is at Wally's House of Embers in Wisconsin Dells, and I was making the owners, their mother had passed away, but I remember them climbing up into the office and pulling out all these old file cards where she had typed out the recipes from the 1950s and 1960s. Just to have that stuff in your hands, it was really moving for me. I found that a little bit with the soul food places, too.
But at the same time, I've talked to, like, Gail Gant, and she has told me she's gone to garage sales, and that little box of recipes with the 3x5 cards is available for 50 cents with all the recipes in there.
Yeah.
And they just gave away a lot of the soul of their family.
Yeah, right.
For 50 cents.
Yeah. How do you, in your organization, how do you find food traditions evolving and changing? Can you think of some good examples?
Well, especially here in the Midwest, things evolve and change because we're a tapestry of immigrants. I have a friend, Penelope Bingham. She considers, for instance, Thanksgiving dinner as the introductory to immigrants on how Americans celebrate it. But at the same time, it's still something that immigrants add to it. And she says, if you're a Vietnamese family and you go to an Italian family for your first Thanksgiving and a lasagna is also on the table, guess what? From that point on, those Vietnamese people will have a lasagna on their table as well.
Yeah.
You know, so things just sort of happen just by our commingling.
I noticed especially in Chicago, a lot of the great soul food restaurants have closed, you know, the Army and Lou's and Gladys's and all that. But I also noticed... in research and in going around that a lot of soul food things are becoming known as Southern food. It's kind of transitioning into Southern food. And I also noticed that younger people aren't eating the fatty stuff that goes into soul food and stuff. Food seems to be morphing a little bit. We did one in Detroit that's vegan soul food. Of course, there's one on the South Side that also has vegan soul food.
Right, or where they're using smoked turkey parts instead of smoked pork.
Yeah.
In fact, for a while I traced soul food restaurants up in Lake County. There was a number of them in the Waukegan, North Chicago, Zion area. You know, as quickly as I'd find them, they would sort of fade away.
Right.
I kind of got frustrated.
Yeah. A lot of mom and pops. Yeah.
Yes, mom and pops. Or restaurants named after the dead aunt. And I'm like, really? You named this after the dead aunt?
Yeah.
You know, with a proud picture of her on the wall.
Yeah. It's funny the things we found out. I mean, like... Army and Lou's closed, but then we went up to Baker's Lounge in Detroit, and they got great macaroni and cheese, and plus it's like the longest-running jazz club in the world. I wanted to include that in there. It turns out the owner, her sister, was with Army and Lou's and stuff. So they got the Army and Lou's recipe, so you can go up to Baker's Lounge in Detroit and have the Army and Lou's macaroni and cheese.
You just have to know that there's that lineage there.
Yeah, it's great.
You know, it's like going, like I'm sure you've done the same thing, going to like the small towns. And there is the diner that's packed, and you got to sit there and look at the menu and try to figure out and ask a few questions. what was the dish that inspired this guy to open the restaurant? What everybody said, that's so good, you should open a restaurant. Because they don't always, they begin to kind of like add diversity to the menu. And what was the core specialty sort of disappears.
Yeah. What's your favorite Midwest state for food? I'm going to put you on the spot.
Oh.
If you want to take a weekend road trip.
Oh, you know.
I like Iowa.
Iowa's darn good,
yeah.
You know, and there's some really good people there, like Jim Duncan, who's doing a lot of documenting of things you can find in Iowa.
I don't know Jim Duncan.
That's okay. He's somebody we ought to know better.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a really
who is
guy.
He?
He is sort of like yourself. He's a freelance food writer. Well, I know you're not a food writer per se,
no.
But his specialty is Iowa. And he is one of our judges often at the Iowa State Fair. And we never leave without getting another tip of some place we ought to visit. And one of them was a ma and pa, kind of like Calumet Fisheries,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Except it was on the Mississippi River. And it was really just ma and pa. And they smoked their own fish. You could get like smoked sturgeon for $5 a pound.
Now, as an organization, you guys do road trips, right?
The biggest road trip is related to going to the state fairs.
And tell us about that.
Since about 2009, we have been sponsoring these family heirloom recipe contests. And for a number of years, we kind of let them just bring whatever. And then somebody suggested we ought to have a theme. And so like this last year, it was food you would serve to family but not to guests. You know, all those dishes that everybody loves, and there's no way grandma or mom would serve that to a guest.
Like what? What would that be?
A lot of hamburger and tomato and macaroni bean type dishes. One of them, it was not this year, but it was another year, and it was sort of the laundry day dish. She would make all this cornmeal, and then she would fold in all the leftovers that hadn't been finished over the weekend into it. And it was, while she was doing laundry, this was baking off. And when people would look at it, I go, it must be Monday.
So that's one. Now, you've got, this is a little bit down the road, April, I'm excited about this. April 8th and 9th, you're going to put together a whole supper club and fish fry thing. I'm looking at some of the details here. Wisconsin Supper Clubs, the food, the drinks, the culture, and with a Friday night fish fry on April 8th. Then I like this, Wisconsin Supper Clubs Roundtable. Tell us about that.
Well, okay, so I was up in Wisconsin at the beginning of December for an event in Madison, and Peter Engler, whom we mentioned earlier, came along, and he brought his collection of supper club menus. And the discussion was on menus kept by the Wisconsin Historical Society. When the event was finished, there was many people wanting to look at his menus as there were people wanting to talk to the presenter. And I realized there was a lot of excitement about these supper clubs.
Yeah.
And then I met, there was this documentarian who's done this documentary, Old Fashioned. And driving home, I was like, you know what? I got several other people. I says, we have a small symposium here.
I told you, and then we're going to take a break. I ran into them doing the documentary when I was doing my book at Turks.
Oh, cool.
Up in Hayward. Turks is the only one in the book that's closed. But like there were like three people in Turks, and two of them were doing research. There was nobody having supper. But anyway, we'll be back with more. I want to talk some more of your upcoming events.
Absolutely.
After this commercial break. Oh.
Flowers waiting in the flat, riding a tom-tom, a double fat bat, a pork-chop sandwich.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. I love it when they let us take over the station, Dan Long. It's ZZ Top. We're here with Catherine Lambrecht of the Greater Midwest Ways Foodways Alliance. What'd you bring me here in this brown paper bag?
I brought you
peanuts and candy and what's this, a brownie?
Those are actually homemade fudge.
Yeah, homemade fudge?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this little packet that I gave you, if you were incarcerated in South Dakota, this would be the sum total of what you would get on Christmas Eve.
Really?
Yes.
Now, how do you know that?
There was an article written by Ruth Steele of South Dakota Magazine.
Okay, I've got it here. I haven't read it. I'll read it after the show. Yeah.
And originally what intrigued me was the recipe because it uses Velveeta cheese to make the fudge. And I was like, I got to try that.
Yeah.
And I wanted my excuse, and about a year ago I did it. And then I read the article with a little bit more detail. And it's like this paper sack, which is like a lunch bag. It has one candy cane, 5 pieces of hard candy, a cup of salted peanuts in the shell, 2 pieces of fudge, and 2 handmade cards from children. You know, it's kind of a charitable thing. The fudge is something that is made, as they call it, on faith, because they have maybe about 3,000 prisoners. They need about 6,000 pieces, and that's all done by charity.
That's fascinating. I didn't know people did stuff like this.
I didn't either. And the other part that was surprising, especially when I brought it to one of my meetings at Culinary Historians, was people went, well, of course they get other things for Christmas. I'm like, no, this is it. They don't get any money. Well, the money can be deposited in their account, but there's no presents. There's no special foods that can be given to them. This is it, and that recipe has to be made exactly to their specification. It has to be wrapped in plastic wrap, but it can't be put into a plastic baggie. So it's like very regulated, but at the same time, they know their clientele and what they should and shouldn't get.
Very good. Well, thanks for bringing that into us.
Yeah,
we're sharing it here in the studio.
You're welcome.
Peanuts. I don't want to get peanuts. So I'm really excited about all your events coming up. Some involve me, but this one doesn't. But I'm really excited about this, the Brownie Wise, the original Tupperware lady. So tell us about this. This is going to be in February 28th.
February 28th.
Highland Park Community House. Go ahead.
Right. I used to be with the Highland Park Historical Society. I am again, but there was a little bit of a gap. And I did this tea, but I would include other people, like a person in character as Bertha Palmer, as Jackie Kennedy. And it was very popular. And when I was not involved with the Historical Society for a while, I bump into people in the grocery store, and they go, could you do that again? And I thought, well, it's a little bit of an outlier for Greater Midwest Foodways, but it gives so much pleasure. And at the same time, I used to kind of apologize for it, but then I realized it's such a mosaic of immigrants in this. Why not an English tea in the Midwest? You know, it's really not a bad idea.
You're having a high tea there.
A high tea. Actually, it's the low tea, but when you tell Americans that it's the low tea, they think they're getting something less. And actually, the English think that's the more sophisticated one because you're sitting at a table. But you tell that to an American and they think you've gypped them.
1 to 3 p.m. on February 28th, an early bird boutique will feature jewelry, hats, purses, and accessories, and Tupperware.
Well, I figured, what the heck? You know, we started this whole boutique thing because people would come early on the train, and they had nothing to do. And a friend of mine does jewelry, another one does hats, and it turned out they even come earlier than noon to get the first picks of the hats.
And Leslie Goddard is the woman who plays Brownie Wise.
She's a fabulous person.
And tell us who Brownie Wise is.
Okay, Brownie Wise was was in marketing at Tupperware, and she got that whole the home party where they would do all their sales. She's the one that launched all that kind of stuff. And she was extremely creative. She did things like when they had their meetings, their sales meetings, she put a big pile of sand or whatever and had Tupperware inside with gift certificates for fur coats and cars. And this is the early 1950s.
Wait, she put sand and then had the gift certificates in the sand?
All these things. It was sort of like, you know, the little kid that sees a bunch of straw and manure and gets all excited and says, there must be a horse underneath.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, it was fur coats and automobiles. And Tupperware kind of, the Mr. Tupperware, Mr. Tupper of Tupperware, sort of got jealous and released her. And then a few months later, sold the company for $15 million. And that's in 1950s money.
Is Tupperware still
out
there?
Oh, yeah, it's still out there.
Then at 7 o'clock on Thursday, January 14th at the Highland Park Public Library, what are we doing?
We're going to talk about you and your book on soul food and the civil rights movement,
okay,
which is fascinating. I told this to somebody today, and she was like, you're kidding. You got to tell. I'm going to be there.
That's good. Now, do you want my? You know, I got a PowerPoint. I haven't even talked to you about this event.
Oh yeah, please.
I've been working on my PowerPoint. It needs a lot.
And
of work.
Is it right if I record as a podcast?
Yeah, you can do that.
All right. So we're
you know, and you know, I have worked with you guys before, and in the time we have left, I did want to get a thematic question out there. I think was it. You did the thing over at
Was it Kendall?
Yeah.
And it was Road Food.
Road Food, right. And,
right.
Yeah, and there was a
Michael
theme.
Stern was
Michael
there.
Stern, and I think this is a really interesting point. Didn't he have a thing about, like, will that spoil regional food? I mean, the world is becoming so big. What's happening to regionalism? What's happening to regional food?
You know what? There's some things. Sort of like I remember he described like the fried ravioli, where at one point you could only go to St. Louis and get fried ravioli, and now you can find it in many restaurants across the country. I think, yes, there are some things like that that just take off and have a life of their own, but I think regionalism still exists. I mean, you go into a little grocery store in the middle of nowhere, there's potato chips that were made relatively locally by a brand you never heard of. You know, there's like that Mon Pa fish, you know, fish smokers on the Mississippi River. It's there. You just have to dig a little deeper.
If you had to pick a unique regional food for Chicago or the Chicago area, what would you say? I mean, not pizza or anything, but we're beyond that.
Oh, you mean unique to Chicago?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, that's, you know, why don't we talk about unique to the Midwest?
Okay.
How about Burmese? Fort Wayne, Indiana, has 15,000 Burmese. For a couple of years, Peter and I were going through there to get to like Ohio State Fair and to.
That's
Indiana
a good state fair.
Fair.
I've been to that one. Not as good as the Iowa State Fair.
Iowa State Fair is terrific. Is terrific, and we were like, there were number of Burmese restaurants. Not, I mean, like two or three, but that's a lot when you go to some other places. There's zero, like Chicago. And there were several Burmese grocery stores. And there was all sorts of things going on. And we couldn't understand what was going on until I found somebody who said, this is the Welcome Center for Immigration and Naturalization. They come to Fort Wayne, Indiana. But you go to Huron, South Dakota. They have a population of Burmese. They're there. They were originally brought in to process turkeys.
I've been to Fort Wayne several times. I didn't know that. I know about that great diner in downtown Fort Wayne, but I didn't know about the Burmese thing.
Oh, you know what? I'm kicking myself because there was the Lincoln Museum there, and I didn't go there before it closed. And I said, oh, I cannot devote, you know, 8 hours round trip just to, you know, to see the Lincoln Museum. Had I understood the food situation there, not a problem.
Real quick, we got a break, but do you and Peter ever eat in the car, or do you always get out to eat? I mean, is there some,
well,
you guys,
okay, my friend,
I picture you guys eating hamburgers or hot dogs driving around.
We do it all.
Yeah.
You know, in the car, you know, he'll pull out a camera and I won't pull out a camera because I kind of think it's one thing to have one picture of a food, but to have two, three pictures of food is a little goofy.
Well, thanks for coming in. Give us the website again.
GreaterMidwestFoodways.com. And that's greater with an E-R.